Tina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
Welcome in. Legal Face Off on WGN and WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are here. Rich Linkoff and Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich in a brand new studio to boot in the brand new building here at WGN. Plenty to get to per usual. Two candidates running for mayor against Rahm Emanuel here in Chicago. New regulations from the DOJ and a possible commutation for Rod Blagojevich, plus the legal grab bag at the end of the show. But we start with Lori Lightfoot, lightfootforchicago.com, on running against the mayor in Chicago.
Thanks for joining us, Lori. So early last week, you had announced that you're running for mayor against Rahm Emanuel. This is on the heels of your resignation as the president of the Chicago Police Board, which is a position that the mayor had placed you in. What made you decide that this is the right time to throw your hat into what has become a very crowded ring for mayor?
Right. There's a lot of folks who are stepping up to the tee. Well, I just fundamentally came to believe some time ago that the city was going in the wrong direction. And I kept waiting for the mayor to step up and address, I think, some of the significant challenges that we have, both at an individual and neighborhood level. And I just didn't see that leadership happening. You know, things like, for example, the fact that we have a very regressive tax burden that places undue pressure and burden on middle and lower income families and individuals. The fact that we have, obviously violence is a significant issue in our city, and we need to have a comprehensive plan to address not just the immediate vestiges and manifestations of the violence, but really what's going on at the neighborhood level that is driving the violence. In my view, violence is a symptom of a community that's in distress. We have things like, 40% of African-American children live in poverty. We have unemployment. We have lack of jobs and other opportunities. So we need a comprehensive plan to deal with that, and that will absolutely help drive down the violence. But is that and other issues that led me to feel like there needed to be an articulation of a new progressive course for the city?
Lori, picking up on one of the points you raised, there's a recent study that you, in fact, have referenced in your campaign thus far that on the west side of Chicago, life expectancy is 69 compared to 85 years for someone who's living in the Loop, which is 7 L stops away. Right. How do you, as mayor, plan to bridge some of that gap, some of that disparity?
Well, I think, frankly, we follow the model of Westside United on a range of different issues, but let me talk specifically about that. The hospitals, the Affordable Care Act mandated that hospitals who provide charity work must do a community needs assessment. So there's a whole host of data, literally stretching from the north to the south, east and west, about what's happening at the community level. And this is obviously from a healthcare perspective, but the information that's there is valuable and can be used. Those institutions and individuals on the west side came together, united, to address a specific community need. But unfortunately, the city's not at the table in that initiative. But if we took that model and used data-driven policy initiatives, brought people to the table on the front end to help solve solutions, that is something that I think is absolutely a moral and, frankly, economic imperative for a mayor of a major urban city to address and has to happen in this city, but it's not happening. So if you pick the issue, we have world-class talent all across the city, at the neighborhood level, at the academy, in business and philanthropy and civil rights community and on and on. So we have all the tools at our disposal to take on these tough challenges. But you need a leader who can be a catalyst for change, who sees the need and isn't afraid to roll up her sleeves and get the job done. And that's exactly what I will do as mayor.
So what do you are touted as having a very progressive platform, and you've just shared with us some of what you think needs to happen. How would you go about implementing this progressive platform? For example, you talk a lot about fostering an environment and community that is based on inclusion and equality.
Yes. Well, I think it goes to what I've been saying so far, which is, One is recognizing the needs that are out there, recognizing that even in the most distressed communities, there are people who are doing incredible work. Like, I had the opportunity recently to attend a peace march in the Back of the Yards neighborhood. And that has got to be one of the most challenged neighborhoods in our city, both from a crime perspective, economic development. Obviously, they have a significant immigrant population that has all sorts of needs. But yet, people in that community have ownership of their destiny. They are doing everything that they can to change the narrative, and not just by words, but by deeds. I think as mayor, you follow that example and follow their lead and make sure that they have a spotlight on the good things that they're doing and have the resources that they need to be successful, and make sure that the city is there as a partner and welcoming that grassroots activity. That's my sense of a progressive vision that is really manifesting equity and inclusion.
Lori, we covered last week the Obama Presidential Center issue, the opponents to putting that in Jackson Park. Where do you stand on that issue?
Well, look, I think that the fact that the president has chosen Chicago as a location is all a good thing. And frankly, I think that the folks at the grassroots level have really compelled a change in the narrative that is important, and they should be applauded for that work. I mean, obviously, I'll be watching the developments very, very closely to make sure that whatever the final plans are continue to be reflective of the needs of the people in that community. And I feel confident that we will get there.
Lori, we talked a little bit about your work in police misconduct.
Yeah.
If you were mayor of Chicago, how would you have dealt with the Laquan McDonald videotape?
Well, look, obviously, a lot of things that happened with that whole process. It's not just the videotape, but that whole process were wrong. And we spoke, I think, at length about that in the Police Accountability Task Force report, which is why one of the first things that we recommended as part of our work was that we have to have a real, consistent policy about producing videotapes, audio tapes, police reports in these very high-profile actions where lives of community members are directly affected. Our policy in short strokes is you got to get that information out as quickly as possible to the public, and it needs to happen no later than 60 days after the incident happens. We asked the city, as part of our recommendation, to go back, which would have been in 2017, would have been the look back, to see if that 60-day period could be shrunk. We haven't heard anything from them as to whether that is. But more to the point, I think with me as mayor, because I know these issues so intimately, we don't have to wait for a Department of Justice or an Attorney General or even a court. I'm going to make sure that the very good and solid recommendations, both of the task force and the Department of Justice, are implemented, because we need to strengthen the support that we have around our officers, particularly in the areas of training. But it goes beyond that, because if you think about what's going on in our neighborhoods and you think about the kids for whom, unfortunately, fear is an organizing tool in their lives from the earliest days, we need our police officers to be successful in fulfilling their mission of serving and protecting the community. But we need them, of course, to do it in a constitutional and respectful way where they recognize that respectful engagement with the community is every bit as powerful a tool as their gun and their badge. Steps have been taken and some progress has been made, but not nearly enough. And we still haven't taken on some of the big challenges, systemic challenges that were identified both by the task force and by the Department of Justice. And we're not going to have to wait when I'm mayor. It's going to happen.
Thank you, Lori. Appreciate it.
Great.
Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina is chair of DLA Piper's Intellectual Property Practice Group in Chicago, and she serves as the firm's national hiring partner for associate recruiting. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell, and
selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is a columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host. She frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. DLA Piper is a global law firm with lawyers located in more than 40 countries throughout the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia Pacific. DLA Piper is positioned to help its clients with their legal needs around the world. To learn more about DLA Piper, please contact Tina or visit DLAPiper.com.
You can follow Legal Faceoff on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook and always find the show on iTunes. Search for Legal Faceoff. Up next, a conversation with a man who's run for mayor before. He's doing it again here in 2018. Paul Vallis, VallisForAllChicago.com.
Paul, thanks for joining Legal Faceoff.
Well, thanks for having me.
Paul, it's great to have you on with us. So last month, you announced that you are running for mayor along with a whole slew of others. You obviously have a very long history of public service, including as the former CEO of the Chicago Public Schools and as the former City Hall Budget Director. What made you decide to throw your hat into the ring?
Well, I think the city's in deep trouble. We have more murders in Chicago than L.A. and New York combined. The schools have been in constant crisis. You can just tick off the crisis from, and I think the most significant crisis the schools is facing has been a significant reduction in enrollment, which obviously impacts everything. But from the, you know, from the mismanaged closing of schools to the controversial Supes contract, $20 million contract that landed a superintendent, as well as a vendor or vendors in jail, to the to the most recent controversy, their failure to respond to accusations and evidence of sexual abuse. It's been just one crisis after another. And I also think I'm also running because I really think we're rapidly becoming the tale of two cities. I mean, there are the development in and around the Loop and within three or four mile radius of the Loop has been significant. That development began long before Rahm Emanuel became mayor, and other areas of the city have gone virtually ignored. I mean, there are areas of the city on the west side and the south side that have not recovered from the Great Recession, and in fact, some areas on the west side haven't recovered from the 1968 riots. And when you consider that, I think Chicago is close to the bottom among the big cities in terms of employment growth, but that the city's property values have declined by 17% since their pre-recession levels, where in contrast, the property values nationwide have grown by 7 or 8%. I mean, that is not a healthy sign. That impacts everything. It expands the tax burden to the remaining property owners and to the remaining property taxpayers. And so the decline in city enrollment, the decline in the value of property, the escalating crime rate, the inequities in the distribution of city resources, and of course, the uncertainty and the controversies surrounding the schools.
Let's jump in on that, Paul.
Sitting out there, I think all those problems have motivated me to get into this race.
Let's jump in a little deeper on the school issue, because obviously that is one that you're intimately familiar with as an issue, but also you mentioned the daily news right now about the sexual abuse scandal. And in particular, one of the issues is that the law department is charged with investigating these issues, but they're also responsible for defending the district if abused students file lawsuits. There's news this morning that will be taken away from them. But what does that say about the overall culture at CPS, and what are your feelings about how that lands on the mayor's doorstep?
Well, look, the mayor's had four superintendents in 7 years. What does that tell you? You recently had this the mayor lashing out against Aramark because 73% of their schools failed their cleanliness test. So they had basically 73% failure rate. But yet that same week, they get a $267 million contract extension. I mean, the mayor, I think it lays right on the mayor's desk You know, I'd like to see the emails between City Hall and the school district in terms of the correspondence that was going on during the period within which the Tribune was doing this investigation. I mean, the city didn't start acting, didn't start aggressively acting until after the Tribune had presented their findings to the school district CEO. So, for the Emanuel administration, it's all about politics. It's all about managing the issue, the issue of the day, staying on top of things politically. It's not, they put politics over policy, and I think it's reflected in their mismanagement of the schools, their mismanagement of their budget, their mismanagement of city economic development resources. So I think that it was more about trying to suppress the story and then trying to spin the story. And now, of course, they're obviously reacting, but only after. Look, the inspector general had asked for that investigatory power days, if not a week before. City Hall finally came around to it and had a big press conference indicating that now the inspector general will be conducting these investigations. They should have had the inspector general investigate these issues when they first got the intel that these things were going on in these schools in the first place. And it's clear that a lot of this information was circulating, that there was certainly enough information to warrant a serious investigation or a serious reassessment of how they investigate these cases within the school district long before the Tribune story ever ran. So, I think the buck stops in the mayor's office. He appoints the CEO. He appoints the board. It's this handpicked board. And I think the responsibility lays with him.
So, Paul, why don't you talk to us for a minute about public safety and what you think we could do better in that regard?
Well, I think, and a lot of this is based on things that we did, many, many, many years ago. I believe that public safety, when it comes to the schools, is a 24/7 responsibility. Our approach was, first of all, to have a separate police command. Now, the Chicago Police Command, but I have all the police officers in the schools and the off-duty police officers who work in the schools under a separate commander, so that these officers were really kind of schooled and trained in how to deal with students and how to interact with students. So they became known to the community, they became known to the kids, and the kids in turn, they're familiar with the kids. It was a way to gather intelligence, and it was a way with that separate police command, when we had incidents involving students who were at risk, not only in the schools, but also at risk in their homes, in the community, what we would do was we would have 24-hour, 7-day-a-week intervention. So in other words, if we had a student who was a victim of violence on a Saturday or Sunday, if we have students who were being intimidated by gangbangers, if we had students who were being constantly bullied, we would do something about it. We would get the information, and we would dispatch either our youth outreach officers or we would file a report with the police department and we would investigate. So our approach was to be very, very aggressive. And I think what they need to do is they need to institute an infrastructure, a public safety infrastructure that provides these type of protections and provides these type of crisis intervention services. Let me tell you what that would consist of. The first thing it would consist of would be reconsolidating the police command so that you have a single police commander and that the police officers who work in the schools are trained to work in the schools, because this would ensure that there are the police resources available and that the police are there. They're gathering intelligence and they're obviously working with the students and they know how to interact with the students. The second thing that would be required is that you set up a mechanism that allows information to be accessed. In our day, it was 24/7 student hotlines. You would call in, provide the information or provide the lead, or usually anonymously, about what you had heard or what was going on or over a hotline. Now you can do it through social media. There are social media platforms that you could set up, which would allow information to be accessed, intelligence to be gathered, and then a determination to be made what to do with that intelligence. So setting up that reporting, that 24/7 reporting apparatus, would be something that you would need to do. And then the third thing that you would need to do is to have a series of protocols. First of all, I'm glad that the Inspector General is going to be doing these investigations, but I think if you have a self-contained police police unit under a single command in the schools that specializes in student safety. And if you have the appropriate intergovernmental links with the Department of Children and Family Services, then when something happens that that impacts students, you automatically, the police, it triggers, if appropriate, a police investigation. It triggers activating that relationship with the Department of Children and the State Department of Children and Family Services, so that the appropriate agencies are conducting these investigations and that you're having the appropriate follow through. So this is not rocket science, you know. And what's absolutely critically important is training. Principals and teachers down to custodial staff and support staff all need consistent and constant and repetitive training in how to deal with these situations, when things are brought to their attention, what to do, how to react. And not only in cases of sexual abuse, but also in cases where students are being intimidated or students are being threatened. When we created our hotlines in the various school districts I've operated, we used to get information about who was bringing a gun to school, or who was trying to get a gun into school, or who was suicidal, or who was which students were having serious drug problems and opioid problems. So we were constantly gathering information that we could respond to. So making sure that you have a highly trained police unit working in the schools, number one. Number two, making sure that you've got a reporting infrastructure so that information can flow, intelligence can be gathered, and determinations made about what the right interventions. And number three, you know, having the right type of relationship so that you have the appropriate entities investigating incidents or investigating risks being posed to students, whether it's happening on the school grounds or whether it's happening on the weekends or at home. Having the capacity to do that, I think those are the fundamental things that you can do to make the schools not only safe from sexual predators, but also to make the schools and the children safe from gangbangers or from threats in the community with the proliferation of guns and just the elevation of crime, which is victimizing so many of our young people throughout the city.
Paul, last question. We've only got about 2 minutes left on Legal Face-Off. Okay. We just saw a deposition testimony released this week of Mayor Emanuel and Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson in the Quintonio LaGreer lawsuit that goes to trial on Monday. Superintendent Johnson said under oath that he has never heard an officer talk about a code of silence. What are your thoughts on a code of silence? And bigger picture, what would you do as mayor to improve relations between the community and police?
Oh, goodness gracious, 2 minutes?
I know, that's not a lot of time on a big issue. One.
Do I believe that there's a code of silence? No, there's four police officers in my family. And one who passed away, who was a three-decade detective, Area 1 homicide, Pete Felzer. So, no, I mean, I don't believe that there's a code of silence. I think in very large organizations, there are going to be people who are not suited for those jobs and who basically act inappropriately. And I think, sometimes in a small minority of cases, I think there may be some individuals who are reluctant to talk about other individuals. I think the larger the organization, the greater likelihood that you'll have a larger number of people who basically maybe do not act responsibly. Either they're not reacting responsibly because of their actions, or they're not reacting responsibly because they're not disseminating the information. But is there some sort of understated or unofficial code of silence? No, I don't believe that for 1 minute. I think what you've got to do, you have to understand what's happened to this police department. This police department has been decimated. It's been decimated by budget cuts. The mayor promised 1,000 police officers. I think they eliminated close to 2,000 vacancies. The detectives division was literally cut in half. We went from 1,200 detectives to 600 detectives. Now they're rapidly trying to get back up to that 1,200 number. That's why we're only solving one out of every six homicides. And the supervisory staff was gutted. And the training has been deplorable, totally inefficient. So when you have overworked police officers, because you don't have a number of police officers, you don't have beat integrity, you're moving police officers all around the city. When you don't have the right supervisory infrastructure, in other words, you don't have one sergeant for every 10 officers, you have one sergeant for every 30 officers, you don't have enough training officers, you know, and when you don't have enough police, police support resources in place, you have overworked detectives, you have exhausted detectives handling dozens and dozens of new cases every month. I mean, that leads to a breakdown. It leads to a breakdown in efficiency. It leads to a breakdown in accountability. Building up police strength also means building the infrastructure so that you have the type of command and control that ensures not only do you have effective policing, but you have accountable policing. And I think that's what's happened. And finally, when you wait literally 5 to 6 years to start equipping your officers with tasers and then training them on how to use the tasers, not to mention giving them the type of training that they need so that there are clear alternatives to the use of deadly force. I mean, this is absolutely irresponsible. So, you know, so I think at the heart of the problem when it comes to the police is the fact that they've been under-resourced, they've been under-supervised, they've been under-trained, and I think that's been a big part of the problem.
ValisForAllChicago.com. Paul Vallis, the election is in 8 months. We'd love to have you back on for a candidate forum between now and the election.
Well, thank you. I look forward to that. Anytime.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
We roll along on Legal Face-Off with a return guest, Robert Blagojevich, a small business owner and the author of Fundraiser A, My Fight for Freedom and Justice, with the news that his brother Rod may be released from federal prison.
Robert, thanks for coming back on the show. We appreciate it. You're a frequent guest, and we really love having you on. Talk to us about your feelings with the news of President Trump considering a commutation of your brother's sentence.
Well, it's very encouraging news. I'm cautiously optimistic. And if President Trump were able to find it in him to help my brother be reunited with his family, I think that would be a great injustice corrected. And so I'm cautiously optimistic.
Do we have any sense as to what the timeline is on it and when the final decision will be made?
I've got no timeline. It's up to the president. I think we're all anxiously waiting to find out what he does and when he does it, if he does it. There's nothing certain here.
Yeah, he's received a lot of criticism from opponents, not just to this possible action, but pardons of others for a variety of reasons, right? I mean, some have questioned, the reason that he's considering commuting your brother's sentence, that he's only doing it for public relations, that he's only doing it for celebrities. Others have talked about the fact that he's not going through the traditional process, going through the pardon attorney in the White House, that he's, really doing this off the cuff. What is your response to that? Again, understanding that you went through 2.5 years of being the subject of a DOJ investigation that was ultimately dropped. We know from reading your book the details of that. But what's your feeling to those who criticize this process?
You know, President Trump is a political disruptor. He's gone to Washington, D.C., and he's turning it upside down. If you look at the entrenched bureaucracy that's in the, inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., you've got people working with impunity. They have no accountability anywhere. And with regard to my brother, a 14-year sentence for someone who took no money, hurt no one, and to have been taken away from his family that long, to me, is an injustice. And I think the president sees that. And I think if you've seen some of the other pardons that he's done, you can see that there's a reason for that that goes beyond politics. I think it's humanity. I honestly think he's trying to do the right thing, the thing for people. And if you look at this lady that was just released after, I don't know how many years in prison, 20-some years, for an egregiously harsh penalty, he is trying to right wrongs that the justice system imposes on American citizens, because you've got all kinds of mechanisms in the system that are so lined up against defendants, you don't have a chance. I'm just very lucky to have survived a 96% conviction rate. So the president, I think, is trying to undo wrongs that have been done to people. And I wouldn't be surprised if he digs in deeper and touches on a lot of people that we've never heard of who've been screwed by the system.
Speaking of that, Robert, your book, Fundraiser A, My Fight for Freedom and Justice, is a fascinating read. It talks about your journey through the legal system. Ultimately, these charges were dropped, we know. It was just announced yesterday. We just heard from the DOJ Inspector General's report that former FBI Director Robert Comey exercised poor judgment in his investigation of the Hillary Clinton email issue. Does that finding reinforce your feelings about the unchecked power, in your opinion, of the federal government?
There's no question about that. We were wiretapped for 50 days. And during those 50 days, I did nothing wrong. And the FBI took bits and pieces of conversations and made a federal case and referred it to Patrick Fitzgerald, who ultimately indicted me. And then once I was indicted, they came to my lawyer and asked me to cut a deal if I would work with them and give them a global solution, which to me is an outrageous request. And I said, of course, no, I've done nothing wrong and I have nothing bad to say about my brother. And that's when the reality of how corrupt and broken our justice system is. And so when I read about it, I see all that has gone on in Washington under Comey and the DOJ, it outrages me. And I have written about it in my book. I've written editorials. I've spoken to law schools, colleges. If it can happen to me, it can happen to anybody. And our civil liberties truly are under siege here. And if you look at what has happened to the president, and if you want to compare and contrast to Hillary Clinton, there is a dual-tiered justice system. And we were taught in elementary school and high school that we're all equal under the law. My experience tells me that is not true, sadly not true, and I hope we all wake up as a citizenry and elect people who are going to reform the system.
Robert, back to your brother, Patty, his wife, your sister-in-law, has been very vocal throughout this process, and especially lately with this news of a possible commutation, in describing the toll it's taken on the family, in particular her two daughters. You have been vocal on our show and in prior discussions about your relationship with your brother and how it's had its ups and downs. What toll do you think this takes on your brother, knowing that this is possible? And what about the effect on the family if this doesn't happen? That's got to be incredibly disappointing, to be thinking that they might be reunited with their father. And if it doesn't happen, that's got to be incredibly painful.
Well, I would imagine it would be. Unfortunately, my brother and I continue to be estranged. I've had no contact with Patty and my nieces. And that, of course, is a personal family matter. But setting that aside, I want nothing more than for my brother to be reunited with his daughters, who he is, during this incarceration, has missed many of their formative years. And if he were to be reunited, that can all hopefully be repaired quickly and he can get on with his life, but it would certainly be a devastating impact, I'm sure, on my nieces if the president really didn't do anything. And so, you know, we get our hopes up, but we've got to manage them because you just never know. And certainly, having gone through the criminal justice system, having been prosecuted, things that you thought were going your way because you thought you understood the law and you understood what you were facing would just be flipped upside down 180. And I can't tell you how many times I said to my lawyer, well, I don't understand this. This makes no sense to me. Why is this right when it's clearly wrong? And so I would hope that the president has it in his heart not to build up everyone's hopes and then dash them by not doing anything.
Robert Blagojevich joining us on Legal Faceoff on WGN, real estate entrepreneur, public speaker, and author of Fundraiser A, My Fight for Freedom and Justice. Robert, thanks for calling in. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Our last guest on Legal Faceoff this week, Carla Altmaier, who's the co-founder and co-director at Healing to Action. And Carla will join us to talk about the new regulations from the Department of Justice.
Carla, thanks for being a return guest on our show. We want to talk to you about a bunch of different issues. But first and foremost, Attorney General Jeff Sessions on Monday of this week made it difficult, some say all but impossible, for asylum seekers to gain entry into the United States who are victims of domestic abuse. Can you talk to us about your feelings on that?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and inviting me again on your show, Rich. So I think, you know, in understanding the decision, it's very clear that Attorney General Sessions narrowly construed the portion of the law which talks about who, you know, what grounds a person can seek asylum into the United States. So there are three main elements, right? An applicant has to prove a fear of return to their country. They have to prove that the government is unable or unwilling to protect them, or that they are directly being persecuted by the government, and that it has to be that their fear is on account of race, religion, nationality, or membership in a particular social group or political opinion. And that membership in a particular social group is a very broad term. There really isn't any explanation that the UN gave when they established that term. And so courts since the 1980s have been really working to figure out what that actually means. And it's clear that in Jeff Sessions' Attorney General Sessions' opinion, he is really, defining it very narrowly, explaining that, essentially that survivors of domestic violence do not have a trait that is immutable or unique enough to be considered as a particular social group. And that's interesting because I think during these times that we're talking about Me Too and gender-based violence, it's very clear that these are immutable characteristics, that a person who's experienced gender-based violence is unable to change that from their life. As I said, this is a very narrow definition.
All right, Carla, how does this play into the greater picture of the Me Too movement? And tell us what your organization is doing in light of the developments that this movement has made, certainly since the last time you've been on the show, but in the last year.
In terms of its relation to the Me Too movement, I think what it is, it's a blow to the movement in the sense that it's not really recognizing the permanence of an experience of gender-based violence. And with Healing to Action, one of the things that we've been working on is collaborating with worker leaders across Chicago. So these are low-wage workers who are working as domestic workers, restaurant workers, who have experienced gender-based violence and who are wanting to push solutions that reflect the realities of their experiences. So we've been collaborating with them in the last year to identify what are those skills and tools that they'd like to learn to be become advocates and change agents and advocate to decision makers like Attorney General Jeff Sessions? And then what are those solutions that they are wanting to work on? And it's clear that a lot of the communities that we're working with, and they are communities mostly of color with a lot of immigrant workers, this issue of immigration is on their mind, but the issue of preventing gender-based violence is also on their mind. So there's even ideas of, pushing for better or more holistic sexual education programs in public schools.
So, Carla, there are some incredibly staggering statistics about the frequency and severity of the sexual violence problem, particularly among the lowest income bracket. I saw that it appears that they're 12 times more likely to experience sexual violence than others in higher earning brackets. Can you tell us a little bit more about this? And you had started to tell us about some of the solutions that your organization and others are working towards. Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. So with low wage workers and in workers in poverty and women in poverty, there is an increased likelihood of experiencing gender-based violence, not just in the workplace, but in the home. And one of the things that we've seen with, that has been highlighted and spotlighted during the Me Too movement has been the increased or the rampant violence that low-wage workers experience in the workplace. So, for instance, anywhere between 60 to 90% of workers in the agricultural industry or hotel housekeeping industry or restaurant industry have reported experiencing workplace sexual violence. And you're also thinking about these are workers who really do not have economic power, right? They are at the whim of their employer, earning low wages, unable to, afford a retirement or even afford childcare. So one of the, what the work that we've been doing has really been to lift up the voices and the leadership of these workers, but also really the needs and highlight the realities that these workers are facing and thinking about how to advocate for legislation that is about preventing gender-based violence, which really means advancing solutions that are grounded in both economic and gender equity policies.
Carla, how could people help? How could our listeners help?
Absolutely, Rich. So I think for Healing to Action, we have a fundraiser that's coming up. I think donations really, really are key in supporting this work. And we have our fundraiser coming up on September 25th. I think another way really is lending your expertise. I think we have a lot of legal experts out there who could support either provide pro bono representation to survivors who are starting to come forward, or even provide connecting with other, other types of professionals out there who have other forms of expertise like media and marketing to help move and amplify these stories that are being told.
Thank you so much, Carla, for joining us. The website again is?
Yes, thank you so much. It's so our website is www.healingtoaction.org, and you can follow us on Facebook at Healing to Action and also on Twitter at Healing to Action. Thank you so much, Rich.
Thanks for joining us on WGN.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
First up on the legal grab bag today, Tina, the Supreme Court has decided not to touch the Wrigley rooftop issue. So as most of our listeners are probably aware, the Cubs have been embroiled in litigation with a couple of the remaining rooftop owners in Wrigleyville. For those of you who don't know, on the north side of Chicago, there's a place called Wrigley Field. And for years, you would go up to the rooftops of these buildings and enjoy a view of the ball game. For years and years, the owners of those rooftops would charge people individually. You would pay your money, come up to the top and enjoy the game. Then a few years ago, the Cubs realized that this is some property that we want to protect. And they reached a deal, a tentative deal, it turns out, with a lot of the rooftop owners to allow them to continue to sell spots on the rooftop and enjoy the game. In exchange, the Cubs were giving up a percentage, or were getting a percentage of revenue from these rooftop owners. Then the Cubs ended up buying up a bunch of the properties. The Ricketts family did. There was two remaining holdouts around Wrigley that decided not to enter into the deal and not to sell the property, and they ended up suing. The case was called Right Field Rooftops versus Chicago Cubs Baseball, and this has been going on for about 3 years. And just this week, the Supreme Court of the United States declined to hear the case. As you probably know, they don't explain why they don't accept cases generally, but they basically let the lower court's decision hold, which means that this case is pretty much done. There are five owners. I expect at this point the remaining five might now sell their property to the Ricketts family, as the others have done, because legally there's not much left.
How sad.
Well, is it? Where do you stand on the idea of, you know, because there was a big debate for years and years about whether the Cubs were really in the right in preserving, you know, this property, and property meaning the game. And they put up, as you know, billboards to prevent the view. For a while, they put up sort of a screen. I feel like, you know, if I'm the Cubs, they're doing the right thing. Why should you avail yourself of this incredibly valuable product without paying something for it? So I think the rooftop owners are probably facing the end of the line here.
I concur.
All right, moving on to new associates. The $190,000 question is, who will raise salaries for new lawyers? Winston & Strawn, which is a large multinational law firm, has just announced plans to increase the salary for first-year attorneys by $10,000 to, get ready, Ben, $190,000. That is the starting salary for a first-year associate at Winston & Strawn. So these are not people who have really accomplished much more than getting their law degree, getting through law school. They don't have a track record to sell to clients, and they're getting paid $190,000. This is on the heels of a firm in New York, Milbank Tweed. This stuff always starts in New York. They set the trend for salaries. They bumped salaries on June 4th to $190,000, as I mentioned, and going up to $330,000 for lawyers 8 years into their careers. So, you know, for a while, and this is, you know, ebb and flow. We always see the trend. Generally, it goes up. For a while there during the recession, salaries were going down on the, with the idea of companies not willing to pay these high salaries to unproven lawyers anymore, taking a lot more of the work in-house to people like our friend David Sussler. But now the trend seems to be back towards escalating salaries. Tina, you're with a big firm. You're head of
Recruiting.
Associate recruiting. So you deal with this issue every day.
Yes.
Your thoughts?
I think, well, it's all about the competition for talent, right? But when I look back to when you and I started practicing, Rich, we weren't making nearly this kind of money. And you also have to be concerned about what clients think.
I paid my employer for my first job. I think I owe them money at the end of when I saw that paycheck.
Thanks for giving me that boatload of work. I'll write you a check right now. You know, we have to be concerned about what corporate America thinks, because there are a number of clients out there that don't even want to pay anything for a first or second year on their file. So, I think it's just a very delicate needle we're threading here. Obviously need to compete for top talent, and it's a marketplace for the talent, but you also have to be mindful what the clients think.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, I think right now the market, is strong for candidates, especially candidates who are going to firms that will pay the salary. You know, on the other hand, if you're a corporation, if you're a business, and you're looking to outside counsel, it would be hard to justify paying someone those rates who doesn't have a long track record. But, you know, as always in the legal business, to compete, as you mentioned, other firms will elevate their salaries to compete. All right, Tina, next story is a victim of the always dangerous flying pasta. I can't think of the last time I went to an Italian restaurant where there wasn't spaghetti and angel hair flying around the restaurant.
Yeah, I was going to say, who would have thought that ragu and pasta was going to be a deadly combination? So back in 2015, Constance Colmey was eating in an Italian restaurant in Connecticut when she got hit by flying pasta. She was actually trying to exit the restaurant at the time that the incident happened. A dish full of pasta with red sauce struck her in the head. The thrower of the pasta was engaged in an argument with another person. The thrower, the defendant, was an attorney. And as a result of the flying pasta, sauce dripped into Constance's eyes, causing her to fall and hit her head, which then led to a concussion, eye pain, headaches, neck pain, back pain, and elevated blood pressure. So in her lawsuit, she sought damages for negligence and battery. The defendant claimed that he was acting in self-defense and that the plaintiff had misrepresented the incident, and then she actually had pre-existing back and neck conditions that were not attributable to the incident. The jury deliberated for 3.5 hours and came back and awarded her $85,000. So I guess the moral of the story is avoid the flying pasta whenever
you
can.
Watch out for that flying spaghetti. It's always... and that people will sue for anything, right?
Yes, exactly.
Moving, or continuing, I should say, on the trend of food-related lawsuits. Tina, we have some lemonade issues.
We do have some lemonade issues. So, you know, I never thought growing up that if I had a lemonade stand that I could end up getting fined and shut down by the police. But apparently it happens quite a bit. And Country Time Lemonade is coming to children's rescue. So as it turns out, the lemonade company is paying up to $300 to cover fines and costs that children incur when they are setting up lemonade stands. The program, which is very cutely called Legal Aid, with aid spelled A-D-E, is the company's attempt to take a stand on children's behalf. The company said it first started intervening a few weeks ago when boys in Denver, Colorado were running a lemonade stand for charity and got a visit from the police.
An illegal one.
Yes.
A boiler room lemonade stand.
And as it turns out, the police shut the lemonade stand down after receiving a complaint. I'm not quite sure who complains about lemonade stands, but be that as it may. And it was later determined that the boys did not need a permit for the lemonade stand after all. So under this program, Country Time says it reimburses the cost of fines or permits for children who are 14 or under when parents fill out a registration form and upload an image of their children's lemonade stand along with a description of what the lemonade stand means to their children. So once the company pays up to $60,000 in these fines, it's going to close the program down for the season. The program is set to conclude by August 31st, and Country Time said that it will nevertheless continue to help children by donating $1 for a total of up to $500,000 every time that their legal aid video is retweeted. So I think we should all take a look for that video on Twitter and retweet it.
I think a kid should do like a legal advice stand, you know, I mean,
I like it.
Yeah, you're driving.
Is it the unauthorized practice of law and dispensing
of
lemonade?
Kids, who cares? But maybe, maybe Legal Face-Off will sponsor any fines resulting from bad legal advice at the legal aid stands.
I like it.
Next on Legal Grab Bag, Tina, Velcro, just Velcro. That's the story, right?
Yeah, it's about Velcro.
Velcro lawyers
and fake lawyers on video.
That's right.
So for all of you
in the intellectual property segment of the show,
which we always said,
Tina Martini, ladies and gentlemen.
So this is a great story for all of you trademark geeks like me who are out there. So I don't know how many of you in our listenership remember that last September, Velcro released a video where there were actors pretending like to be lawyers who explained in a song all these different things about Velcro's IP, including the fact that the patent had lapsed and that the company has trademark rights in the name Velcro, but those rights are weakening because people consistently use the mark inappropriately. For those of you who are not familiar with the concept of trademark genericide, what that means is... trademark.
Who wouldn't be familiar with that? That's such a common term that everyone knows it, right?
Hey, I genericide. Know what it means. Yeah, it's genericide. So what happens is if you use a mark improperly, you end up losing the rights over time. Because what happens is if you use the brand name, which is the trademark, to refer to the thing rather than a brand of whatever that product is.
Can we give some examples? Or
yes,
gonna,
absolutely. Aspirin, dry
Kleenex.
Kleenex is not generic.
Oh, why is that?
Well, because they've actually made very concerted attempts to keep it from becoming generic.
Q-tips?
Q-tips are not, that's not generic. Cellophane,
wow.
Escalator, all of those were brand names that through improper
escalator
use
was.
Became a noun. Yes. Remember, trademarks are adjectives and not nouns.
Mm.
So
very
in
good.
Any event, so in the new video, Velcro played off of its old video from last fall. The same actors returned playing the same lawyers. And they are singing the comments that they received from the public who watched the video. The video is actually hilarious. I encourage everybody to watch it because some of the comments that were made are pretty funny. And the Velcro actors sing a lot of these comments. And there's a lot of bleeping that happens. Don't say Velcro.
That's what they're singing, right?
But yeah, but they also, some of the comments that were received from people who watched last fall's video include, please hook and loop your heads out of your asses, which I think is pretty funny. And who are all these bleeping clowns? So it was interesting. So Velcro's in-house trademark counsel said that they view this whole video campaign as a success because apparently the first video has been viewed more than 550,000 times.
Wow.
And people are
How many of those were by Tina Martini, I wonder?
Only two.
Right. I don't believe that.
And the rest of my trademark team.
Yes.
But apparently it is successful in as much as people are not using Velcro as incorrectly as they used to. And they're using the verbiage hook and loop fasteners instead. So.
All right. Now on to the people in trouble segment of the news. Before we get to that, let's start with that one. John Schneider from the Dukes of Hazzard. One of Tina Martini's favorite shows. I know Sussler.
Oh, yeah.
Sussler loves the Dukes of Hazzard, right? John Schneider was just released from jail and interestingly said that he experienced a conservative bias as a result of being in jail. He returned to his Louisiana home after being in LA County jail for a couple days. He was jailed, for failing to pay alimony. He said he could not afford the payments. He says he has been hit with hard financial times and spent most of his money repairing his movie studio in Louisiana after it was destroyed by a flood. He filed for divorce in 2014. They have three children together, and he cannot pay alimony. But interestingly, like I mentioned, he said that he is the victim of a bias against conservatives, Republicans, and Hollywood. He said that, I think if you let that alter how you are, then I question how you are. If you believe it, speak it, live it. He's been outspoken in the past about his support of Donald Trump. And again, is now saying that he is the victim of this conservative bias. So
I've never heard this before, and I just find it hard to believe.
Nothing to do with him failing to pay his alimony.
Yeah, I was just going to say, he's completely
he's a Trump
faultless.
Supporter.
He's faultless in all of this.
I was a big Dukes of Hazzard guy growing up, though.
You Luke know, it's funny. Duke. I saw it, but I wasn't a big fan.
Luke and
I was
Bo.
More Starsky and Hutch.
Starsky and Hutch. That was your go-to crime-fighting. You didn't wear the Daisy Dukes?
No, I did not.
Speaking of genericizing something, there's a perfect example. Daisy Dukes are now the common term for cut-off jeans.
That is true.
No one calls them cut-off jeans. They call them Daisy Dukes.
They call them Daisy Dukes.
After the marvelous Catherine Bach back in the...
Whatever happened to her?
She is now a spokesperson for Daisy Duke Jeans, apparently.
No,
I don't know. Last story on Legal Face-Off. Reggie Bush is now owed $12.5 million from the L.A. Rams. Reggie Bush, former Heisman Trophy winner, actually was taken away from him. Only times that's happened besides O.J. Simpson. He was in his 10th NFL season playing for the San Francisco 49ers when he suffered a meniscus tear after returning a punt against the Rams while playing at the Edward Jones Dome in St. Louis. He landed awkwardly after slipping on concrete and was ruled out for the remainder of the season. He did play in 13 more games before calling it quits. And this week, the Rams were ordered to pay $4.95 million in compensatory damages and another $7.5 million in punitive damages as a result of this injury. He called the field at the time as the concrete ring of death. There's other players who have been injured on this notorious surface. Josh McNown had injured his shoulder after slipping on the same surface a week before. They cover the area with rubber padding. So, You know, this speaks to a lot of legal issues. The fact that the Rams knew about this condition as a result of this other injury and tried to remedy it unsuccessfully, that played into this judge, into this large verdict. But yeah, that field is notorious for just literally being a thin amount of grass over just concrete. So Reggie Bush coming out with $12.5 million.
Wow.
Tina Martini, good show. Good first show at our new studios.
Yes, the studio is spectacular.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Ben. And thanks, of course, to Sam Panianovich. We'll see you in 2 weeks on Legal Face Off on WGN.
See ya.